A lot of relationships showing the dependence of efficiency on things you can measure experimentally, and some aspects of the current models, the Tianjin model on carbon dissolution, and the work we've done in the United States on understanding what is necessary to make any common piece of charcoal an efficient anode. Today, however, we're going to talk only about the experimental apparatus that you use to make these measurements. And I hope this will give you the kind of information you need. Not all of this is available in the literature. In fact, most of it is not. But it may give you the ideas you need in order to set up and run a successful laboratory experiment in carbon fuel cell, if that's what you decide to do. We're going to start out with just a couple of repeats in case somebody is here today that wasn't here yesterday. Defining direct carbon fuel cell and what it is, the difficulty of working with carbon fuel cells, and then I'd like to give a brief history of the experimental techniques going back a little over 100 years, about 110 years from today when research in this area started. I'm going to make some specific configurations, describe them in detail, things we did at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory and published in our public papers. And then finally, after reviewing the necessity of determining simultaneously off-gas composition and cell polarization, you have to do that at the same time, like to make some recommendations for an approach to a simple cell that can be built at a low cost, and it gives first-rate information. Again, what the carbon fuel cell is, basically, it's a block or a slurry of carbon sitting on a sand barrier, and then on top, below that is a oxygen reduction catalyst, lithiated nickel oxide, for example, and then some kind of an air flow-through channel. This completes the circuit. So electrons must leave the carbon for this to be a direct carbon fuel cell, go through an external circuit, and combine with air. If the electrons don't leave the carbon and go through the circuit, it's not direct carbon fuel cell. It may still consume solid carbon, but you will pay for that in reduced efficiency. Okay. We would like to apply this to a number of different configurations. I could just run out of battery. That's okay. To fossil carbons or to carbons derived from renewable biomass, such as charcoal and agricultural waste. It works on both sources of fuels. We expect the hardware to be below $1,000 per kilowatt, and power to produce somewhere between 3 and 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is competitive with many markets already in the world. The efficiency is between 70 and 80% at peak, and we can make low-cost cells out of graphite and refractory ceramics. Okay, I went through the definition of total or overall efficiency. It's a product of a number of terms. Here they are. Basically, all this reduces to a very simple equation here. The total efficiency is the product of the coulombic efficiency and the actual voltage divided by 1.02 volts, which is the theoretical voltage. The coulombic efficiency is the number of electrons here transferred per atom of carbon divided by 4. So if you get CO2 as the product, you have 100% efficiency. And then coulombic efficiency is typically measured by you apply a current stepwise, you wait about an hour, make sure you're at steady state, and you measure simultaneously the carbon dioxide and the carbon monoxide output from a simple mass balance on the right. You get these equations here, allows you to express the coulombic efficiency as a function of gas concentrations, and then data shown here. The coulombic efficiency, it always increases with current density. It should extrapolate back to the Boudouard open circuit condition, For some reason, it doesn't always do so. I think it's due to a time lag of getting to a steady state and the sluggishness of the concentration to respond to the current. But always it approaches one at a relatively high current density. Okay. The difficulty in determining total efficiency derives from a number of things. Carbonate is a very corrosive material, and it tends to wet the surface of beakers and climb out of the cell. At least when you want it not to occur, it doesn't seem to be there sometimes. Weight loss has been used many times in the early literature to determine how much carbon is lost for how many electrons are taken from it. But that's difficult because you can't really get all the salt out of the interior of the particles, and sometimes the carbon will disintegrate to small amounts inside the cell. Very easy to get a small error in weight loss that results in a large area in determination of coulombic efficiency. So very early, we sort of ignored that altogether, and we went to integral carbon dioxide production rates. We would pass current for a certain amount of times, determine the amp hours, and we divide that into the number of moles of carbon dioxide that are produced, and from that we get an effective valence, and from that a coulombic efficiency. One thing that must be done is that you have to take some measure of off-gas composition and analysis simultaneously with the voltage determination. And those two together, taken at the same time or at least in the same equipment on the same day, will give you a measure of the coulombic efficiency. Okay. Now, a brief history. In 1896, William Jaques in Boston, Massachusetts, developed and tested the first carbon air fuel battery. It wasn't a true fuel cell because the electrolyte changed its composition over time. Nonetheless, it was a huge step in the direction of making an electrochemical conversion of carbon to electricity. He typically worked with cylinders of iron, cast iron, about a meter high, about that big around, and he'd have one or more bars of carbon sticking into it. These were made by compressing coal into coke, current collector over the top, and then he would blow air into the molten salt underneath it, and it would come up the sides, and the air would react more rapidly on the iron surface. It's a catalyst for oxygen reduction, not a very good one, but it certainly worked, and it had very little impact on the oxidation of the carbon. As I mentioned yesterday, you can take a slurry of carbon particles and molten salt, pour it out on the tabletop anywhere from a few hundred up to 750 degrees Celsius, nothing happens. The carbonate protects the carbon from oxidation from the air because of diffusion through the layer of salt. The salt that he used was, in fact, sodium hydroxide, not sodium carbonate. And gradually, over time, the KOH would react with the product carbon dioxide to make potassium carbonate. This equation right here should give you a voltage of 1.4 volts. It doesn't, because the reaction here, carbon plus oxygen going to CO2, tends to dominate in the very short term, and that gives you very close to a 1 volt that you need and that you expect from this reaction. The transport-limited CO2 reaction occurs within KOH, and okay, thank you. There we go. A company called Sera, about 10 years ago, redeveloped this work and tried to get carbon dioxide out of it continuously without any conversion to potassium carbonate. They later retracted claims that they could prevent the formation of potassium carbonate despite adding water to the system. It's not true. Unfortunately, that early claims that you can stop potassium hydroxide from going to potassium carbonate just by adding more water, those are all retracted, but it is stuck in the literature, in the corporate memory, you could say, and troubles us still today. The carbon potassium hydroxide fuel battery consumes 7 carbons of caustic for every carbon, or kilogram of carbon, 7 kilograms of caustic for every kilogram of carbon. That makes it uneconomic, and it gives no net energy yield because it takes a lot of energy to make KOH. It's a chloralkali product, and takes a lot of electricity. It has no economic significance, but the scale up is very interesting. Each one of these big cells here is 1.6 kilowatts. He made them into batteries of 10, 16 kilowatts. He planned to put two 16 kilowatt systems on board an electrified steamship, and drive it up and down the Charles River in Boston. I don't think he ever got that far, but he did make these enormous batteries of 16 kilowatts out of this very basic reaction. Okay, the first evidence that CO2 could be the primary product from carbon oxidation continuously and at a rate predicted from the current was found by Tabaru and Kamada, 1935, two Japanese scientists working, I believe, in Switzerland and publishing in German. They found that the carbon dioxide was the primary product from the oxidation of charcoal made from it was a certain kind of tree. I can't remember the tree that they used. It was experiments done at 550 to 700 degrees. They actually screwed a current collector right into a block of charcoal. They put some cement around it for sealing, and they immersed it in a cell and measured the voltage. And then they also collected, not shown here, there was a little funnel over the top. They collected the off gas and measured that. And they got a measure for the effective valence, which is the coulombic efficiency. They also did weight loss and confirmed the gas measurements with the weight loss. But here's the final result. It's the first confirmation that CO2 was produced from carbonate melt, despite the predictions of the Boudoir equilibrium, which says that at this temperature, you really shouldn't be getting a lot of CO2, about 50%. In fact, they were getting 100% CO2, and that was a very strong confirmation of this kind of a technology. About 50 years later, 40 years later, Kim Hauser from University of Oregon in Salem conducted a detailed study of graphite electrolysis in molten carbonate at temperatures between 650 and almost 900 degrees Celsius. And he found four graphite rods, quarter inch in diameter, about a half centimeter in diameter, that the primary reaction at the carbon anode was carbon plus two carbonates going to three carbon dioxides and four electrons. There was a unit transfer of carbonate from the cathode to the anode. His configuration went to great pains to separate the air cathode gas evolution. He would actually pump down in here oxygen and CO2, 1-to-2 ratio. It would bubble up on the inside surface. This metal here, this tube, is made out of gold with 20% palladium, a particular resistance to corrosion of carbonate. And he made the liner of the cell also out of gold, 0.2 palladium. Not very economical situations here. The buoyancy of the bubbles, they would come up here and they break over the surface and be pumped out of the system, was supported by the hydrodynamics here. Any bubbles that would form here on the surface would crawl up here and back into the channel here, and there would be a flow of electrolyte through it like that. Apparently it worked. He also has a carbon as well as a gas reference electrode. Here's a carbon electrode. It's just a sample of the same graphite he used, but no current, operating as some kind of reference electrode. And then a true reference electrode here, which was made by gold and pumping oxygen CO2, 1-to-2 ratio, over the surface and pulsing the level of electrolyte up and down. Here's the level of electrolyte. And here, this is carbon anode that he tested. He put a funnel over it in some experiments to collect the off gas for measurements. Here were the results. The The carbon to carbon dioxide ratio versus current density was measured at the steady state. Here's the current density, 0 to 140 milliamps per square centimeter. Here we have the log of the ratio, 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 1. At 10 to the minus 1, very roughly, the prolomic efficiency is just over 90%. But look at the current, or the temperature. The temperature is 870 degrees. And at that temperature, you should get no CO2 at all, or very immeasurably small, from the predictions of the boudoir equilibrium. But in fact, you get almost 90% carbon dioxide. And at 800 degrees, you get 98% Coulombic efficiency, and so on. Now again, this is only for graphite. It's not for turbostratic carbon. And when you looked at the actual voltage over potentials on these, they were quite high, and they weren't really useful in a carbon fuel cell. Nevertheless, that was a major step forward in confirming that under certain conditions, the primary reaction product of a carbon fuel cell at these temperatures should be CO2, not something predicted from the Boudoir equilibrium. What I've done is I've taken the data from Hauser and calculated the Coulombic efficiency as a function of the ratio of carbon dioxide to carbon dioxide plus carbon monoxide, and replotted that same data here. So for 600, 700, and 800 degrees, these charts over here, they're above 94% Coulombic efficiency. For 700 and 600, above 98. At 870, I had to change the axis. It's about a maximum of 87, 85, 87%. So that's merely changing a ratio of CO to CO2 to a true Coulombic efficiency. Okay. I'd like to skip a few years ahead to work done at SRI near Stanford University in California. I've actually met some of the people who have done this work. The work was done particularly by Robert Weaver and Leonard Nannis. Leonard Nannis is a fairly famous electrochemist in the United States. He was the person who invented the technique for putting magnetic oxide films, iron oxide films, on floppy disks when computers used to use floppy disks. But he did this work, and I'm reporting some of it here. This is the copy, a picture of the cell that they used. He used 30 square centimeter pressed char anodes made from coal, for example. And the carbon electrode here was attached to a rigid graphite rod that went up through a housing made of aluminum tubes out the top. He would put in helium flush out the system gases to a mass spec to measure the ratio of carbon dioxide to carbon monoxide. The electrolyte circuit was completed by going down around this corner into the cathode chamber. The cathode, in turn, was a rod of also a graphite, as I recall. Yeah, it was. And that evolved carbon monoxide when it was put under cathodic conditions. They can either add carbon dioxide and reduce the carbon dioxide to carbonate, or they can reduce the carbonate to carbon monoxide, either one. But the tortuous path between here and here prevented this electrolyte and the gases that were evolved from mixing with the gases which were then collected and tested. A very interesting point. It's very difficult to make a seal to a crucible of alumina and a plate of alumina. So what they did is they made a metal flange that went around the outer surface. They glued it on with cement, ceramic cement, and they put on a copper O-ring, and then clamps held it together, and that's how they made their seal, and it did work. Now, what did SRI test in this cell? They tested anodes which happened to fulfill most of the properties which we have later learned are required to make a very efficient anode. Low porosity, relatively high conductivity, and high density. Those are the things we're after. And they got it as an artifact of pressing the coal powder together and sintering it at temperatures of anywhere from 500 and 1100 degrees. Here is their summary of how they did it. Anode preparation and properties. Coal powder was compressed 200 to 1000 PSI at 500 degrees Celsius. They did this actually a couple times in some cases. Their off gas was discarded. When it held together, they raised the temperature to 1000 degrees for a heat treatment. Times weren't given, but I understand this was like overnight. So they just baked it. And they baked it until they got a resistance that they're looking for in the final baked out product. The resistance they wanted was about 0.01 ohm centimeters. This should be ohm centimeters, not ohm square centimeters. The density was about 1 gram per cubic centimeter, so this is still a fairly porous material, but the pores now are isolated and very small. The modulus of rupture was reasonably high. The porosity about 50%. From this, the density should be 2, it's 1, therefore it's 50%. And the pore size ranges between 1 and 100 micrometers, a nominal 50 micrometers. This came from a report which is from 1979. I happen to have a copy of it. It's generally not in the public literature.